from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Last month, 43 students disappeared after a clash with police that killed six. They were last seen in the custody of local police in Iguala, Mexico, where drug ties run deep. The search for the teachers in training, bright sons and daughters of rural campesinos, has uncovered a trail of unmarked mass graves. But where are the students? Their disappearance has sparked outrage even in Mexico, where there has been so much death and disappearance. This hour on Point, we're going back and going deep on Mexico's missing 43 and the meaning of the outrage in and over Iguala. Joining me first today from Mexico City in Mexico is Tracy Wilkinson, Mexico Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. She's been covering the story. Cabot Prize winner for excellence in reporting on Latin America. Tracy Wilkinson, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Can you describe to us what happened on that day in late September?
Yes, exactly a month ago. The students were gathering, heading to Iguala, apparently to collect some money to continue some protests that they were planning. There are conflicting versions over that exactly, but that's what we understand was happening. They commandeered some buses, as they often do. We're headed to Iguala when the mayor there apparently got wind they were coming, and his wife, the mayor's wife, who was an official at a local social welfare agency, was having a party and a speech to celebrate her accomplishments. He was afraid that the students would disrupt the ceremonies, and, you know, and they do have a history of being a pretty contentious group. So he ordered his police chief, allegedly, to take care of them, to attack and intercept the students. The police took control of the highway, intercepted the students. A couple of different shootouts over the evening, over the night and early next day took place. Six people were killed, and a large group of students, it was actually more than 43 initially, some escaped, were taken away by the police. 43 have not been seen since.
Tracy, describe where this is. This is not, at least on the map, this does not look in the middle of nowhere. This is just maybe 100, 120 miles south of Mexico City, a couple hundred miles north of Acapulco. What's the terrain, what's the culture, the social, I don't know, standing or character of this area?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. Geographically, it is not very far from Mexico City. It is between Mexico City and Acapulco, two, you know, very well-known places, very visited, very important. Acapulco, very important to the national economy. But Guerrero, the state, has a long history of all sorts of rebellion. It was the center of the revolution, the Mexican Revolution, in the beginning of the 1900s, a long history of guerrilla insurgency, very aggressive student movements, and vigilante groups. So it does have a long, very belligerent history, I guess, with a lot of revolutionary currents. The schools the school where these students came from is part of a system called normal schools that were colleges set up out of the revolution specifically to teach poor children of peasants and campesinos and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's a very unique system, and it is sort of steeped in revolutionary rhetoric and very politicized and even radicalized. But the terrain is it's rough terrain. It's very mountainous. There are parts of the state of Guerrero, even though on the map it doesn't look far away, they could be last century in terms of development, neglect from the government, a lot of indigenous communities. There was a hurricane last year that, you know, just wiped out entire villages that, you know, we didn't even hear about for a few days. So that's how sort of, you know, the distance is in terms other than geography.
So these young people are really the sort of cream of the crop from the countryside there, if they're headed off to these schools, I presume.
Yes, they're people with aspirations. You know, I've talked to parents, and they said, my son just wanted to better himself, just wanted to be a teacher, just wanted to you know, have a better life and help his family, you know, to go beyond where the parents had been able to go. Again, there is a lot of politics involved and ideology involved, But yes, these would be the best and the brightest from the countryside. That's a good way of putting it.
On the other side of this equation, you have the mayor and his wife and maybe more, but just start there. They've disappeared now on the lam, I guess. You've got the Attorney General of Mexico saying that they were in pay of a local criminal gang that paid them $230,000 a month, and the police department another $50,000 a month. I guess this is a drug dealing gang, and the mayor's wife, her brothers are part of it?
Yes, I'm not sure who was paying whom, because the Attorney General has said both that the mayor was paying the drug cartel and the drug cartel was paying the mayor. So everyone was getting paid off one way or another. But and yes, the wife has brothers who are top lieutenants in one drug cartel, and this other cartel in Guerrero called Guerreros Unidos, which basically means people united of Guerrero,
yep.
I guess,
yep.
is pretty much in control of large parts of the state and very much in cahoots, according to the Attorney General, with city halls all over Guerrero. The mayor of Iguala being the most, I guess, egregious example. And after the students disappeared and as the heat was building, Jose Luis Abarca took a leave of absence. And he and his wife sort of bid farewell to the city council, walked out, and have not been seen since. They are on the lam. Initially, federal authorities wanted them for questioning, but now the Attorney General has said outright they are suspects as the people who ordered the attack on the students. And we haven't seen them. An arrest warrant is out, and we'll see if they get caught at some point.
The bodies, we're told, have not been found, though in the search for them in the mountains, many bodies have been found, including substantial mass graves, Tracy.
Yes, I think we're up now to 11 mass graves, 38 bodies, just in that small area. And so far, none have been identified as the students, they're still looking for the students. But sadly, this phenomenon of hidden graves is not new in Mexico. For the last several years, as you know, thousands and thousands of people have been killed and thousands have gone missing, we have also found many, many hidden mass graves that have produced people who, you know, were killed either, you know, in battles among the cartels or you know, kidnapped and slaughtered for various reasons. So sadly, the phenomenon of mass graves is not unique to this particular story. But yes, as authorities have found out looking for the students, they keep stumbling across, you know, more burials.
Some are speculating that one of these, maybe the 28 badly burned bodies, may indeed be the students, and the government just doesn't want to acknowledge that. Where on earth does the where does this come from? Who feels empowered to do something like this? This ferocious response. I mean, one of those who died on that day, one of these students, the skin was peeled off their face. Their eyeballs were torn out. Who feels the impunity to do something like this? What sort of sense of authority or power are they riding on?
Well, that's a very good question, and that goes right to the heart of this. You know, on the one hand, this entire incident is not surprising given the context of what has been going on in Mexico for the last 8 or 9 years. As I said, thousands of people have been killed and thousands missing as, you know, the drug cartels and other criminal networks have extended their reach.
But this is so politically tinged, Tracy, forgive me, but they weren't trying to take over a drug cartel's business.
No, they weren't. But I'm mm-hmm. describing this climate of impunity that has grown out of this. So. And as I was saying, on the one hand, it's not surprising given the context, but on the other hand, this is beyond the pale. This is, you know, even the most hardened person watching what's going on in Mexico cannot help but be taken aback by this, be shocked by this. And exactly what kind of impunity, you know, how could a mayor, if you know, as the allegation goes, think he can simply make 43 or how many ever disappear and get away with it. It is the crux of the impunity here, that the complete breakdown of law and order in parts of Mexico, and an issue largely neglected, I have to say, by this government. since in the last 2 years that that Enrique Peña Nieto has been president, and he has sort of hoped it would all go away, but in fact it has just gotten worse and deepened. And I think in a lot of the more distant parts and remote parts and out of control parts of Mexico, there is no law and order, and so a mayor decides he can get away with this. As for the level of brutality, we have seen awful, awful things. You mentioned the peeling of the student's skin. There have been beheadings. There have been people, bodies dissolved in acid, and all sorts of horrible things because you get away with it. So few people are ever prosecuted or captured that it just creates this climate that you are going to get away with it.
And big protests around Mexico, even for Mexicans. This, as you say, was too much. I want to come back and look at that, the political implications, the dynamics of what went on in Iguala around this massacre and disappearance, mass graves. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The sound there of teachers and students protesting last week in Iguala, Mexico, smashing windows, setting fire to the city's main government building after 43 students at a teaching school there in the mountains south of Mexico City disappeared, in most quarters now presumed dead, murdered by some alliance, it appears, of local government and drug dealers. All kinds of uproar over it in Mexico, well beyond that town in the mountains now. Here's a mother of one of the 43 missing students talking with Fusion's Manuel Rueda, saying she prays for her son's safe return. I pray for the kids to return safely. I pray to God they come back all right. Many do not anticipate that will now happen. Some already did. Here's the uncle of one of three who were killed immediately in that clash with police in September.
I lost my nephew, said this man, and I want justice. Given that they brutally killed him, we want justice. That's it.
Here's the president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, talking to the country last week about exactly this, these missing young students, the cream of the crop of the campesinos in this area, saying he is as dismayed by the missing students as the protesting public, interpreted here by Telesur English.
Créanme que el presidente de la República hace suyo.
Believe me, this president of the republic is presenting this feeling of indignation, rejection, and consternation that has been provoked by the disappearance of 43 youth.
But many are not buying it. Here last week, Wednesday, in Mexico City, tens of thousands of Mexicans protesting over these missing students. Talking this hour about what happened in Iguala. What is going on here? Callers with us, Diane. Thanks for calling, Diane. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling to tell you that I was out there on the street. I'm sorry my voice is shaking because it's so hard to even think about this.
Which street and when, Diane? Which and where? What?
Mexico City, over 100,000 from the UNAM, from the polytechnics, from the high schools, from the normal schools, the teachers' colleges, all around, the parents.
Just last week, you were there, and what did you see?
The parents marched in. People had torches, candles, pictures of the 43 everywhere. The chemistry students were there in their lab coats. The med students were there in their lab coats. Their faculties marched with them. People came from neighborhoods around the city. People came from far away. A delegation came all the way from Chiapas in the far south because they've lost lots of people, too.
Diane, why this time? I'm sorry to interrupt, but if I may ask, why this time? Because this has been going on for years and years and years, versions of this in Mexico. And right around this town, Iguala, is where they found one of the first big mass graves. 2010, they were throwing bodies down a deep mine shaft there. It's been all over. Why this outrage this time?
The outrage has been there all along. The ability to make it public, and because this was so egregious, and they couldn't deny it, they didn't do it at night, they didn't pick them off one at a time, as they have been doing in Chiapas. They took them all in broad daylight. So many people saw it, and it galvanized the country. That galvanized all of the anguish over all the others who have been lost. The last figure I saw is 2,500 disappeared since 2005, and somebody else wrote in that's a low count. This is just the moment for people to come out and demand an end to this. And I must say that when your guest is talking about aggressive student movements and ideologically driven, or about violence and vigilantes. There are community police in Guerrero that have been trying to protect their own people in the indigenous way of assembly-based government and locally-based police forces. They've been trying to protect, and in many cases succeeding, in protecting people in Guerrero from this virulent threat of narco-based police. I heard a young woman in a meeting a few years ago say that she'd been through some hard stuff in other parts of the country, but where she was trying to work with people in Guerrero, if a young woman was raped by a policeman and reported it, then the policeman's gang came after her, depending which gang he was part of, and then she was listed as a drug-related death because her body was all mutilated when they found her. So people couldn't even report. They couldn't even talk. She couldn't bear it. She had to leave. And she was a seasoned activist scholar who'd been accompanying people through some very hard times. But I see Guerrero as a fractal, not as a total outlier, but a fractal of what's been happening in Mexico. U.S. drug war money has driven a lot of this. I know with good intentions from a lot of people, but, you know, a lot of those 70,000 deaths have been from police and military, not just the narcos. There are kids caught in the crossfire, and it's often used as a pretext for political reprisal. And often the narcos themselves are set upon people as political reprisal by political figures.
Diane, I so appreciate your call, especially you having been there in the streets of Mexico City just last week. I mean, up against this kind of fierce violence, who wouldn't? Who wouldn't be up in arms? Who can blame them if they're angry in these mountains in Mexico? Tracy Wilkinson, we think of this as, we perhaps naively have thought of this as drug cartel wars, but this sounds more like straight up political repression, maybe fueled by drug money, but a much older style of political repression in that guise, Tracy.
Oh, certainly. And I think it's very important to note that this collusion that we see in Iguala between the political class, the police, and the, you know, local gangs is emblematic of, it's not just Iguala, it's not unique to Iguala or to Guerrero for that matter.
And it's not new.
And it's not new, and it's not new, and it has been going on for years, and it occurs in many places of Mexico. I think perhaps what is new is that this government has sought to centralize security policies and such, and so has pretty much allowed a lot of the local authorities to be on their own doing whatever they want to. And so that, again, fuels the impunity. Just to correct one thing your caller said, she said 2,500 as the estimated missing. It's actually 25,000 as the estimated.
I'm sure she just misspoke. That number's in pretty wide circulation.
Just wanted to clarify that. We're talking about a very large number of people.
Miguel in Midland, Texas. Miguel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, how are you doing, Tom?
Okay.
My cousin was one of those people that was in the crossfire of a cartel fight in Chihuahua, Mexico, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
We just celebrated his death. So
I'm sorry.
Anniversary of his death here a few days ago. Mm. And, you know, one of the things that shocked me when I went down there, that there was, it was so normal, you know, to see killings every day, people missing every day, thousands of people in Chihuahua and Juarez, and there was no indignation. People weren't up in arms. It was normal. It was almost like entertainment to them.
Oh.
And I, for one, growing up here in the United States, I was absolutely shocked at how normal it was. And I'm finally proud that people are finally standing up to this corruption and to this narco cultura that's going on in Mexico. And I just got to say, it's about time. I mean, Mexico is due for a revolution of some kind, because I can't believe that people have been living like this for this long, this many years after all this started.
Miguel, I appreciate your call. Proud to see those huge crowds coming out in Mexico City to say enough right here. One more, Drew, at the moment. Drew in Worcester, Massachusetts. Drew, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi, you're on.
I'm just wondering, there's
Oh, you've got your radio on, Drew. Turn your radio off. We'll come back to you. Let me bring in Andrew Seeley. He's Executive VP at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, Senior Advisor to the Mexico Institute at the Wilson Center, author of Decentralization, Democratization, and Informal Power in Mexico. Informal power, indeed. Andrew Seeley in Washington, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
We've been hearing from Tracy in Mexico City. How do you look at what's going on here? What is this representative of? And what's the meaning of the big outpouring of indignation, outrage all over Mexico?
You know, I keep thinking back to something that happened in 2010. There was a massacre of 15 kids in Ciudad Juarez, right across the border from El Paso, Texas. 15 mm-hmm. kids who were completely innocent, not involved in any sort of organized crime, cut down at a party by a local gang. And what happened in Juarez is that the city got really organized. The families became angry. The city became angry. There were national marches across Mexico. And we actually saw a change in policing strategy, a change in the judicial system in Juarez. And Juarez, it, you know, saw violence go down about 80 or 90% in about a 3 or 4 year period. It's, yep. it's still dangerous. There are still drug gangs that operate there, and there are still, you know, serious problems, but it's much better than it was. And I, you know, wonder if this is going to be a detonator for the federal government in Mexico, for the state government in Guerrero.
To do what?
To take this seriously, to actually put some resources in reforming the judicial system, reforming the police, empowering. One of the callers mentioned the community police. There's a really great example in Guerrero of actual communities creating their own police forces.
What, so to defend themselves against narco cartels, against other
against
corrupt police?
Against narco cartels? Yeah, you know, in Guerrero, you really have a mixture of what was political violence and violence driven by complicity between, you know, people in the political system with people with private interests, a lot of big landholders. And then drug violence has really just come in. The drug cartels have come in and just put money into this and made it much worse. But this goes back decades in Guerrero. And so Guerrero really is at this point the most dangerous place in Mexico, but it is not the only one by any means. There are several other places, Tamaulipas, Michoacan, mm-hmm. Parts of Oaxaca that are where you really see this complicity between public authorities and drug traffickers and private interests.
And a kind of tinderbox, and we can understand why. Francis in Bloomington, Illinois. Francis, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I take this, you know, I don't have the information from your previous callers or personal involvement. Mm-hmm. As an American, I have watched this for years and been just amazed that we haven't seen the outpouring from the Mexican people. And your one caller that stated how proud he was that the people were finally standing up, and I'm proud of them too, because this is a myth. And I remember, I think it was after the 2010 incident, that I watched a rather unrenowned documentary, and an expatriate had the guts to say, "You don't see these people prosecuted because the police are the ones that are doing this." And with that, I'll leave you and want to listen more to people that really are more involved in it.
Francis, it sounds like you're pretty tuned in there in Bloomington, and I appreciate your call. Andrew Standby and Tracy Wilkinson in Mexico City with us from Berkeley, California right now is Anabel Hernandez. She is one of Mexico's leading investigative journalists, author of Narcoland, The Mexican Drug Lords and Their Godfathers, contributor to the online news site Reporte Indigo. She's now at the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley. Anabel Hernandez, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
We have seen apparently deep corruption here in this town of Iguala, but many people, Anabel, will suspect, you're the investigative journalist, will suspect that the corruption goes higher. Is the federal government part of a web of corruption here, too?
Yeah, Tom. I have been investigating by several years these ties, the ties between the government and the drug cartels. And for decades, the political power have been involved with the drug cartels in many kind of business and in many kind of levels. Now, these ties are in the highest level. For me, this example, very, very dramatic example of what is happening in Iguala, is just an example of how the things works in Mexico. I mean, when Abarca, the mayor of Iguala, uh-huh. was in campaign, the party that proposed him as a candidate knows that his wife, Maria de los Angeles Pineda Villa, was a member of a family that trafficked drugs in Mexico for decades. I mean, they already know it. And the federal government that helped to Abarca with federal programs in Iguala also knows who was his wife. Everyone now is asking how this happened, but this happened because the government let them to do it.
Let me ask you, Anabel, there's a lot of speculation in Mexico now that, in fact, many of these bodies of these 43 disappeared students have been found, that the 28 bodies who have been found that were burned may be some of those bodies. Is it possible that they have found the bodies, but the government simply does not want to admit how they were killed, that they were, there are reports that they were piled on diesel-soaked wood and burned in a bonfire, some of them not even dead, some of them burned alive? Could those be the bodies?
Tom, as you said, I am in Berkeley now. I was in Mexico City last week. I make a very fast trip, and I start to talk with people at a very high level inside institutions, and I really don't know where are these guys. I mean, I heard stories about some of them still alive in the hands of the drug cartel. I mean, the Guerreros Unidos, this criminal organization. And well, but for example, one father member of the church, El Padre Solalinde, told us last week that all the kids were all the students were dead. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, for me, it's very. It could be Tom. That is maybe horrible. Most horrible thing of this story. Everyone can disappear. This number of students in Mexico. I mean, with absolutely impunity, because for example, in Guerrero exist many rivers on many land to just throw away these bodies.
Let me go to Alejandro in Austin, Texas. Alejandro, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to say that this has been happening for several years now with this
of course.
From the same normal.
Yeah.
Back in 2011, there was the government broke a protest in a highway to Acapulco.
Mm-hmm.
And there was presence of federal police, the state police, and the city police also. So. And in the shooting, they killed two students back then. So it didn't became a... It was covered nationally, but not. It didn't become as big as this was.
But Alejandro, 43 is a very large number for one disappearance. That's a lot of students, a lot of young, bright young people.
Right. So this happened, you know, it's the same with the presence of the federal and state police back in 2011, killed two students. And now they can't really say that they didn't know... the federal government was not really aware of what's going on.
Alejandro, I appreciate your call. Andrew Seeley, do you buy that the federal government would not be part of this? Is there that much autonomy? Could this be going on without some connection?
You know, I don't think the federal government's involved in proactively helping the traffickers. On the contrary, I think they've been going after them. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people look the other way, as Annabelle pointed out. I mean, a lot of people allow corrupt politicians to continue to circulate and give them money. And that's a concern. And hopefully the civic outrage will change that equation.
The civic outrage has caught our attention. So has the simple number of rural, bright, best and brightest students here just disappeared, very possibly massacred in Mexico. It's got Mexicans up in arms. We're following it right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound there of protests far from the locale we've been talking about this hour. This was in Mérida, the capital of Yucatán, Mexico. Anger there over 43 missing students and teachers, many now presumed dead in Mexico, and outrage all over the country, even after years of death, maybe 70,000, years of disappearance, maybe 25,000. This incident last month in Iguala, south of Mexico City, on the way to Acapulco, as Mexicans really standing up and paying attention, maybe standing up to power here in a different way. Tracy, in Mexico City, let me ask you, a listener, Roberto, is communicating a lot with us here. He says, come on, just look at the power structure. He says, Oh Chong, second to the president in Mexico, has a history of harassing, torturing rural students. He says, I don't know, maybe you do, Tracy, that Argentine forensic specialists came to help identify bodies. They were denied access, intimidated. We asked, how does a mayor think he can get away with this? And Roberto writes to us, because the order came from above. What do you say, Tracy?
Well, one thing I would say is there is huge mistrust here in any Mexican government. That speaks to, you were talking about rumors that the bodies have in fact already been found. No one believes what the government tells them in Mexico, and so and I think that contributes to this conviction that the orders came from higher up. You know, we don't know. Late last week, the governor of Guerrero, the state, was forced to step down. Mm-hmm. I think the federal government, Peña Nieto, is hoping that will relieve some of the tensions, and there's no sign that it will. I think that for the forensics, yes, the reason the Argentine forensics were being brought in is because, again, the families did not trust the Mexican authorities to reliably identify the bodies. So all of this goes to a very deep cultural mistrust of the Mexican government, which, you know, is understandable given that the Mexican government has lied so often over the decades, has been involved in repression over the decades. So yes, it's quite understandable that there is a lot of confusion and uncertainty about what the reality is.
Andrew Seeley, the government now has been very focused on the economy, trying to put this behind them, trying to leave this in the past where the war on drugs was so fierce in Mexico. But does that mean that their hands are cleaner, or is it a PR campaign to the world to say, look at our economy, never mind the violence?
You know, we've seen since about 2011, the homicide numbers were going down gradually. This government came in about a year and a half ago, very focused on getting some major reforms on education and energy and other things through, and they were fairly successful at that. Mm-hmm. But they really have not talked about security. I think they trusted that the numbers were going down. This was getting better over time. And what Iguala has reminded everyone is that these problems really are persisting. They've changed location. They're less in the north. There are some great success stories of cities that fought back against crime and are doing much better, like Juarez and Tijuana and Monterrey. But there are states like Guerrero and Michoacán, and in the north also Tamaulipas, that are just as bad and perhaps worse than they were before. And I think you're going to see a shift from Peña Nieto in focusing on this. But we haven't yet seen, I think, the coherent message of solidarity and a commitment to step into Guerrero in the way that they did with Michoacán to try and take on some of these crime groups and the complicities. Because some of the ugly things that come out in this is, you know, as some of the callers have said, some of the panelists have said, I mean, there really is some complicities on the ground between politicians that belong to all the political parties and these criminal groups. And sometimes you have to go against your allies. And that's a tough thing, but it's something the federal government's going to have to do.
But this, Anabel Hernandez, this looks, yes, of course, this is related to the drug trade, but it also can look almost like straight up political repression when these are, you know, best and brightest students from the peasantry, the campesinos, standing up against corruption, and boom, they're killed. It looks heavily just political, Anabel.
Well, Tom, I'm really not sure. You have to remember that the wife of the mayor, Pineda Villa, mm-hmm. as I told you,
yes.
was a member of the One Cartel. The Attorney General of Mexico, Murillo Caram, told us last week that she ordered to attack the students that day. She, the member of the cartel, gave the order to do it. I just want to tell that when she became the first lady in Iguala, she started to buy the society, to penetrate the society by many ways. She started to bring to the people food. She started to bring to the people, to buy to the people houses, materials of construction,
yes.
And also wedding dresses. I mean, this woman with dirty money, with the money from the cartel,
mm-hmm.
start to buy the city, and no one said nothing against her. Of course, just the students. That's for me. Maybe that's the reason for why that explained why she decided to attack them.
But she was just as ready, apparent as you're saying, to have them killed. Melanie in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Melanie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I really would like to thank you for taking up this topic and having an hour-long program. And I think it's so important that people are aware of what's really going on in Mexico. It's right below the United States. A lot of those people are coming here looking to escape the brutal conditions that they're in. And our news very rarely reports on it. So I'm very happy to hear this. I was living in Mexico for 2 years. Mm. I was living in a small town in Veracruz, which is not mentioned as one of the very bad, bad states.
Yep.
But the conditions were terrible everywhere around us. It was one of the states that had been militarized, so every time we went anywhere, we were stopped by the Marines. We would see trucks full of soldiers with machine guns at the ready all the time. People disappeared from the town that we were in all the time. People were killed. It was absolutely an everyday occurrence. What those people are living in is just horrific.
Melanie, we've paid a lot of attention over the years, but this one just really got our attention again, and I appreciate your call very much. Thank you. In Bowling Green, let me get another from Austin, Texas. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I'm a retired colonel with the Marijuana Air Force, and I know a little bit about the way things are run in Mexico.
And Mike, can you back up a second? A retired colonel with the Marijuana Air Force, does that mean you were a smuggler yourself, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay, so what do you know?
I know there's a word that's called the la mordida, which means the bite. And if you play ball and you pay the mordida up front, you have no problems. Everything's taken care of. And the mordida is spread around to everyone. And as far as the federal government having complicity, I believe that one of your panelists also mentioned that they may not be complicit, but they turn their back on it because they're receiving la mordida, the bite.
And you, having been in the business, you think that goes right up the chain?
Well, I've pretty much seen it, yes, sir.
Yeah. So how can Mexicans get out from being bitten so much, Mike? How do they get out of this?
Well, the mordida has been going on forever, and it will continue forever. In my opinion, what needs to be changed is the American drug laws, because as long as there's a market, they're going to continue. That's like a third world country down there, and they will continue to do what they have to do in order to eat. You can put 20 million people in Mexico City out on the street and protest, and it's not going to change a thing, in my opinion.
American drug laws, the place to look, and that spoken by a former, Mike tells us, drug smuggler himself. Andrew Seeley, is the drug war the problem here? Is that what sets the table for Mexican killing, fighting, repression?
It's certainly part of the equation. I mean, what you have is sort of the American hunger for drugs combined with weak rule of law in Mexico that creates this conflagration that allows things that were already there, because some of these problems were there, to get a lot worse. I have to say, I lived for many years in Tijuana, which was one of the most violent cities in the world at one point, and is now actually a much more peaceful place. It's not perfect by any means, but it is much better than it was. It has a flourishing culinary scene. It's economically active. It's really taking off. And Tijuana is emblematic of a lot of parts of Mexico that are doing incredibly well, that are becoming more middle class, and that have really handled the challenges of rule of law, if not perfectly better. But on the other side, my wife is actually from Guerrero, not far from Iguala. She grew up there. She was born there. And she has, she knows a very different Mexico. And Guerrero, the things that are going on now are not unlike things that happened 30 years ago when she was growing up, 35 years ago when she was growing up in Guerrero. And it's just been magnified by the American drug money that came in, American consumers spending money on this, coming through the cartels,
but
and giving the kind of guns and ammunition to the stuff that was already going on there.
But if you stop the drug war, Andrew, there would still be a drug trade, presumably. How would it change the power dynamics in Mexico?
The only thing that would change is if Americans either stopped consuming narcotics in large quantities, and to be fair, actually, we are consuming much less in terms of cocaine than we used to, actually much, much about half of what we used to about 15 years ago. But if the consumption went way down or it was no longer illegal, you would just see less money going into these criminal organizations. It wouldn't solve the problem because you still have the issue of weak rule of law. It would simply – what the drug trade has done is exacerbate problems that already existed, complicities between private interests and public power – corrupt systems that keep people in very difficult circumstances. Guerrero didn't become bad because of drug trafficking. Drug trafficking made a bad situation much worse.
And this time,
but you have places like Tijuana and Juarez and Monterrey that have fought back, and actually, despite no changes in drug policy, they've really been able to change the equation on the ground because citizens were fed up and they forced policymakers to do something different. So there's some really positive cases out there as well, and there are some that really make you wonder. I mean, I'm not sure Guerrero is necessarily going to come out of this better. I would like to think so, but I'm not sure that's the case.
More power to those who have found a better way here. We're looking at Mexico's latest uproar over disappearing Mexicans, death, the drug trade, political repression. Tracy Wilkinson, what's your sense on balance? Is Mexico moving into better terrain and this Guerrero story is an outlier? Or is it still in the grip of the kind of drug trade, cartels, repression that the students in Iguala were protesting?
Large parts of Mexico still are. As Andrew said, there are some success stories here and there, notably Tijuana, Monterrey, which are wealthy areas with very strong business communities that have been part of this fight back. But large parts of Mexico are still very much consumed by this violence, whether it be, and you really can't separate out sometimes drug gangs versus the politicians versus the police, because they're all in it together. It's like this ball of yarn. They are so you know, tied in together. The collusion is so deep. Many parts of Mexico are still like that. The federal government doesn't want to talk about it. As you mentioned, has tried to emphasize other things, the reforms, energy sector, et cetera, which are important. But, you know, you're not going to get large investment if you've got parts of the country in flames, particularly parts where this investment should be coming in, like Tamaulipas. So I think parts of Mexico, yes, are moving forward, but huge parts are not. And how can you have a whole country where large parts are so, you know, so deep in violence and corruption?
Let me go to Chicago. Miriam is calling from Chicago. Miriam, thank you for calling. You're on.
My name is Miriam. My brother is inside the party that rules right now Mexico. And the only thing that I can say is our Mexican president is in power because of the cartel. The cartel threw so much money to the poor people to vote for Peña Nieto. You always ask how this will change, but you have to realize that until Peña Nieto remains in power, nothing is going to change in my country. Everything is connected. It's a network of mafia that it goes from the president to the poorest town.
Miriam, I appreciate your call. It's a rough line, but we have the accusation, the charge that the president himself has put in power by drug money. Tracy, does that ring true to you?
Well, there are incidents that are well documented where drug money was going to parts of the to encourage people to vote for the PRI. That happened in Michoacan, for example. I think it would be too simple, though, to say drug money put Peña Nieto into office. The PRI has his party, Institutional Revolutionary Party, has a very strong grassroots machinery, and they can turn out the vote by hook or crook. And I think, so I'm sure there was drug money. We know that drug money went into some PRI campaigns, but I think that it would be too simple to say that's what put him in office.
One last call here, Mike in Reading, Mass. Mike, our time is short.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that for the average listener, it's easy to look at this as a remote issue and talk about the sons and daughters of campesinos, but I lived about 20 miles away in Taxco, a colonial silver town, beautiful.
Yeah.
In my experience, people are university professors and dentists and lawyers and all, and people are just, you know, fatigued by the violence down there, much in the way that Americans are about school shootings and things. But this connects to us in the, you know, the Cavalier college kids doing a line on the weekend or whatever it is. Cocaine and legalization and politics and money really need to be examined. But this is in our back door in a way that I think people try to push off sometimes.
Yeah, no question, Mike. I appreciate your call. Annabelle, last word goes to you. Do you see something new happening in the Mexican uproar in the streets over this, Annabelle, or still in the grip of narco power?
Well, Tom, I really think that as Iguala is the example of what is the real power in Mexico. my investigation in through testimonies in criminal cases and a lot of documents that I have in my hands right now proves that the government at all the levels are penetrated by the drug cartels. I can tell you, you are not asking me, but I can tell you that I don't know if the campaign of Enrique Peña Nieto was using money from the drug cartels, but I can tell you that the federal government hasn't put in jail some governors as Thomas Jarrington and Humberto Moreira that belongs to his party that has that are accused in federal courts in here in U.S. of drug trafficking, but in Mexico are protected.
Anabel Hernandez, we wish you luck with your reporting. One of Mexico's leading investigative journalists with us today from Berkeley, California. Thank you, Anabel.
Thanks to you.
Tracy Wilkinson, great L.A. Times Mexico bureau chief in Mexico City. Tracy, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
And Andrew Seeley at the Woodrow Wilson International Center in Washington. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Tom.
And to all our well-informed callers, the same. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.